There's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers humming. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord.
Get ready. Today, June 3rd, 1942, Curtis Mayfield was born, one of the incredible singers and writers of our time, helped create The Impressions, the great hit For Your Precious Love. He did with Jerry Butler, was also part of The Impressions, and we'll be playing his songs all through the course of this hour, remembering him on this day in history, because this is the day that he joined us on this earth on June 1st, 1942. He was a guy who, anybody who grew up in that generation, and even my young producer, Bobby Marvin Holmes, I always call him an old soul. people who know his work knew that he grew in his political consciousness. He was always fighting for civil rights, fighting for change, fighting for the rights of other human beings in the inner cities of our nation. He stood up as his songs did, and his songs stand up forever. And so today we remember Curtis Mayfield, who passed away much too young after he was struck by a light on a stage that left him paralyzed from the waist down. He never stopped writing, he never stopped singing. He kept going until complications from that tragedy took him away. So we'll remember Curtis Mayfield and play his songs throughout the course of the next couple hours to keep his voice in our heads and hearts. And this is also a day someone else who just left us was part of a profound TV show that awakened America to a lot of issues around race, especially awakened a lot of white Americans, I should say, to issues around race and racism and prejudice. And that was All in the Family. Edith Stapleton passed away. She was 90 years old, played Archie Bunker's wife.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played
songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like us, we had it made.
Those were the days. And you knew when you were there.
Dance for girls and men, women. Mister, we could use a man like Herbert Hoover again. Didn't need no welfare state.
Everybody pulled his weight.
G.I. Roller, sour and great. Those were the days.
Oh, she was an incredible actress all of her life, and she will be missed and remembered on as well. That was an amazing show, amazing work that she did of all kinds of roles in her life. It would be not right to pass this day without thinking about her. And two other things I just want to share with you. This day also brings. One was the Clarence Gideon III. Mrs. Gideon was arrested and charged with breaking into a pool room in Florida, and he became this classic case, Gideon versus Rainwhite, that got to the Supreme Court, and it was ruled that a fair trial cannot be realized if the poor man charged with a crime has to face his accusers without a lawyer to assist him. His case changed the nature of that in this country. And now there's a new battle going on called Civil Gideon, which we've been covering a lot on this program, and we'll be covering more in the coming months, which has to do with there should be no person allowed to go to trial, no matter what the case is, criminal or civil, without the right to an attorney. And that's the battle taking place now in America, all based on Clarence Gideon, who is a poor, almost illiterate person and white, who said it was denied a lawyer. His case got the Supreme Court, and it changed the nature of our jurisprudence in terms of saying that poor people, everybody has the right to a lawyer trial. And this was also the day that the man who transformed the Catholic Church, Pope John Paul XXIII, died in 1963. And his Vatican II Council turned the church upside down and caused the kind of debates and discussions happening in the Roman Catholic Church today. He apologized to the Jewish community. He was anti-Nazi, unlike the popes previous to him. He was a man who was a working class man who brought the struggles of real poor people in. And they made him pope, thinking he was going to die and do nothing. But they made him pope, and he died too soon, but did many things. And so today we remember Pope John the 23rd, and 5 years as pope. But he did a huge amount to open the Catholic Church. And so that was this day in history, as we do every morning here on the Mark Steiner Show, try to bring you those perspective, our perspective on who we are, what came before us. We are joined here in studio by correctional officers. We've covered what's been going on in our prisons here for some months now. Actually, for 20 years, we've been covering prisons and prison reform extensively. One of the voices you do not hear on the air a great deal are the voices of the men and women who work in a system. And we thought that it is important to hear those voices. I got an email from Jim Dow a couple of weeks back after he heard our initial show. He is a retired correctional officer who has some interesting things to say about the correctional system and his work there and his perspectives on it. So we wrote him back, and that's what happens when you write the Mark Steiner Show at steinershow@gmail.com and give us your thoughts. We get you on the airwaves with us so you can talk to the people about your thoughts. And he joins us in the studio. Jim Dow, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Also joining us in the studio are Lisa James Henson, a correctional officer at the Chesapeake Detention Facility. Lisa, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we also have Sheila Hill with us. Sheila Hill is a retired correctional officer who worked at Patuxent for more than 20 years before retiring last year. Sheila, welcome. Good to have
you. Thank you.
Good to have you in the studio.
Good morning.
Great to have you here. And Clayton Guyton should be here soon. He is executive director of the Rose Street Community Center and a former correctional officer who now runs a halfway house for men coming out of prison. And he should be here shortly, we hope. Number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Jump on our Facebook page, and I'll check that in a minute to see if you have comments there. You can tweet us, at Mark Steiner. So I'd love to hear your thoughts out there about corrections. Some of you who have worked in prisons, you're a community activist who want to reform prisons, you know, friends and family who have been in prisons or who worked there. Join us with your thoughts and ideas, whoever you are, 410-319-8888. On this cloudy Baltimore morning. So, Jim, you wrote to us a bit about, and so what pushed you to write that email you wrote to us?
I just feel that the corrections is not really dealing with the prison population in a scientific way. It's they're not doing some of the things they used to do, and they're not getting the best out of what they have. Like when I was a correctional specialist back in probably 1980 or 1975, we had correctional specialists. Our job was to deal with the entire inmate. And in that capacity, we helped inmates get jobs. We helped them establish bank accounts. We did home visits. And we dealt with the entire entire prisoner as he was being released and helped them find places to stay. There's nobody doing it exactly like that now, as far as I know of.
You worked in corrections from when to when?
From 1967 to 1990.
So you saw the transition.
Yes.
From there, and that there have been a lot of stories which we'll cover in the course of this program. And Van Smith has published interesting piece last one on May 29th about inmate lawsuits, and we'll talk about those conditions and the culture of prisons, and also the correctional officer culture. And Lisa James Henson, good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
I'd like to both your reactions to the stuff you've been hearing in the news. What's your immediate thought when you see some of your sister correction officers being indicted locally here?
Well,
let me get that mic a little closer to you. Okay. Obviously, we can hear your voice. Right. I'm sorry, my fault. There you go.
That's fine.
Good.
A female myself working in a facility. It wasn't pleasing to hear the things that we heard, but the only thing that I can do as a female is continue to carry myself with the integrity to perform my duties, what I'm supposed to do. Of course, it was troubling to hear what we heard, but at the same time, I do know that there are officers there that is there that are doing their job and come to work every day to do their job. So the ones that were indicted, I was sorry to hear that, but just continue. The officers, the females is there. Do what you are supposed to do and go home because it is a job that we have to do.
And Sheila, how do you perceive this? What was your thought? What were your thoughts? How long have you been retired now? You've been retired for how long?
I'd retired September the 1st.
Okay, so just recently.
Just recently, yeah. It was disheartening. It gave a black eye to corrections, female correctional officers. But there's over 7,500 of us that, you know, continue to do the job every day. 25 years I did the job, and never with an incident as such as what we heard recently.
So what do you think fuels it? What is, I mean, these things don't kind of happen in a vacuum. You know, I'm not saying that every correctional officer obviously is corrupt, because that's not true.
That's not true.
Right? Obviously, that's not true. True. Obviously, it's not true. But there's something that in the world of corrections, in the world of our penal institutions, and that kind of feeds this on some levels, or it wouldn't occur. I mean, you know, when we see things go on, the UCC sees that to mean something's bubbling on the surface. Whenever you work in a place, whenever, I don't care what that place is, you have a sense of what's going on. You know what's going on. You have a sense of what's happening around you, right? I mean, these things don't happen without people knowing it, right?
Well, I would say that correctional facilities are a reflection of the neighborhoods in which the people come from. And so there, if there is a sense of corruption or an officer that's not performing their duties, then we usually notify management, let them know.
I started in 67. I think it was either 65 or 66 where they had a major scandal in the penitentiary. People were going home on unauthorized leaves. People were bringing in alcohol. They didn't have cell phones then, and we didn't have female employees. But one of the things that you have to realize is that an inmate has 24 hours, 7 days a week to try to figure out the best way to get over on correctional officers, and especially female correctional officers. They come up with things, ways to approach females, especially if a female correctional officer is not 100% secure. They might hear some very flattering things. I'm a male, but, you could correct me if I'm wrong. And if they can't figure it out themselves individually, then they can get advice from the other prisoners there as to the best way to approach females to get what they want. And the ones that are not strong enough to resist all of this, you know, succumb to those things.
Lisa, yeah, can you about to say something? Please.
Yes,
do.
I am. I know when I started, it was more training. It was. And not only that, the officers, they tend to look out for each other more. And I will say in a male setting, you have to understand why you are coming to your job. You have to understand you're there for a paycheck and you're there to do what you are supposed to do. I find that sometimes it's not about insecurity. It's not about how you feel. You can get into a conversation with a person and yes, you can, you know, the conversation can go a little further or whatever, but you have to know why you're there. I am a female. I'm here to do my job. I'm here to go home with my family, maintain my family, take care of my family. That's what it's about. You have some females that may get caught up into that, but females have to understand it's a job, and you have to maintain your integrity. Like we always hear, do what you're supposed to do as a female officer. Not even a female officer, but as an officer, period. Do what you are supposed to
so
do.
So what do you think? We've heard a lot. Well, I think since you raised this for a moment, there's so many things to talk about here. But let's start with this. Jim raised this issue. It was raised on our show before. And I'm looking at you because you're both women and correctional officers. And so people say that is the problem, that there should not be women correctional officers in male institutions. And our people would argue there shouldn't be male guards, male correctional officers in female facilities. So and that they just for a number whether it's the inmate's privacy or whether it's things that can happen, let me get to things that can happen in a minute. So what do you think about that?
I don't agree either. Yes, this is. I think that as a female or as a woman working in corrections, it adds a certain balance in that. I'm less likely to be challenged physically. I can diffuse a situation probably.
Explain that further. When you say you can diffuse a situation as a woman.
Well, sometimes, a lot of times you'll hear him say, why are you arguing with her? That could be your mother. That could be your sister. That could be your aunt. Or they already feel that, you know, physically I'm not a threat to them.
Right.
Even though I think I am sometimes. But I think it adds a certain balance in a correctional setting, both males in a female setting or women in a male facility. It really is about your integrity and less about the compliments or things that they may say nice or something. It's really about understanding through training what your job is, and that's to protect the public. And so when you take your job serious, you really get it in your heart that you're protecting the public, you're protecting the inmate, and you're protecting yourself. You have a trifecta there when you go in. Being a woman in corrections, though, in a male facility, you kind of have to carry yourself above and beyond what you would do in a different type of setting, as though I worked in a clothing store. But you still have integrity because you can have things go wrong there. Where clothing store, you might have somebody with not so much integrity stealing from the store. So it's really about training and the character of the person which works there.
But did you find that a lot of inmates try with female correctional officers is to try to get familiar by calling them other than their official title? You know, they might try to call you out of your name, maybe not as much as honey, but call you by your first name or call you by your last name, but not put Mr. or Mrs. in front of it, but try to find little small ways to get in to establish themselves and get more.
Yeah, well, I would say you don't put it past them to try it.
They're there to try it. That's what they do. That's what detainees do, whatever they can do to get by.
And that's when your training tells you, I'm Miss Hill or Officer Hill. And if they refuse to abide by that, then you write an infraction on them for not following the rules. Eventually, you will be known around the institution as she don't play that.
Right.
So let me ask you a couple of questions here that kind of pushes a tad further, because the things that occurred in the show when we talked about this before, and I want listeners to join us here at 410-319-8888. And they're not easy questions, but one of the things that Van Jones wrote about in his article called Jailhouse Shock was that there's an inmate whose name was Toshma McFadden, who filed a lawsuit against correctional officers at the detention center because he would say he was intentionally beaten up. The COs put him in a place with people who were in the BGF, and he was beaten. And he had, you know, said that he'd been an informer and whatever else, and knew he would be beaten. Was beaten, sexually assaulted, and so he went to trial and to court. And this happened a number of times in a number of cases that came out of BCDC. Michael Smith was another inmate who claimed that a number of inmates, like another guards, like Duane Crewe and one of the women who was in fact Antonia Allison, were working with BGF, and they had put him in a cell, and that he had been beaten. And had all these meticulous records, and all these things came on. And then the corrections department itself saw these, yet these people were never removed. They were allowed to remain as correctional officers while they were having relationships, business relationships, and others as well, with members of the BGF. So, I mean, how pervasive do we think that was? And how could everyone around not know that was going on? How could the corrections, you think, allow that to even continue if they knew these things were going on? It feels like it was being ignored.
Well, go ahead, Ms. Hale.
You know, I can't speak to the investigation or the individual cases or even the things that happened there. apparently the department called in the federal to come in and assist because their investigative unit is like the department as a whole, understaffed and unable to handle those. And so the reasons of why it went on so long or even who or how those lawsuits came about, we really can't. I know I can't speak to that because I have no knowledge of that, nor do I have knowledge of the investigation. But clearly, if we see something wrong, it's our job to report it. And then once we report it, it's on the administration to act upon it.
I mean, is there do you have a sense that like in every place you work like this, that there's a that some correctional officers, not all, but are influenced like by a code of silence, that another officer does something, you don't say anything because
that's not true at all. Because
anywhere,
I mean, well, I know with me, I can speak about me. As a sergeant in my facility, as a president of my local, if I know of this behavior, I would not stand by and allow this behavior to happen. It falls back on the individual itself, the person itself. If you're a person, like I said, that go to work, do what you're supposed to do, this behavior may have happened. Like Ms. Hill said, we cannot speak of the investigation. But only thing we can do is continue to train the new people that's coming in. You know, this is not the right behavior.
But you have what's out that you can see, that you have evidence, that you have facts. But there's a constant flow of rumors, some true, some not. How do you know which ones are true and which ones are not? Which ones to report and which ones to ignore? And that was the case when I worked for the division, because everything, like you say, inmates tell you things that are not necessarily true. And so
you report it all.
We report it all, you said. So we can take a break. When we come back, we're going to jump into some of your ideas about how you think the system should change. I'm going to raise some questions about that. And talk about what I was talking to Jim Dow about before we started on the air, before you two both arrived, that has to do with the culture of corrections and how they may be different in different parts of the state and why. We'll come back with all that. And Maggie, you're the first caller up. We're going to come back to your call as soon as we return as we talk about corrections in our state of Maryland, the eyes and experiences of the correctional officers themselves. Stay with us.
Just move on up toward your destination, though you may find from time to time.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, of course, a little more Curtis Mayfield. Moving on up. This is his birthday. We'll celebrate his song during the course of our show. We're talking about what's going on in our prison system with correctional officers. Sheila Hill is a retired correctional officer, as is Jim Dow. Lisa James Henson is an active correctional officer, president of her local, have that right? And a sergeant in the force. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Go on to Facebook and put your ideas there. I'm going there right now. And Maggie, in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Good morning. Peace and blessings to everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mark, for your guests and for all of your contributions, meaning you and your guests, to the people understanding behind the scenes. And I think we, as the people, need to pay more attention to what is going on in the prison system, because we are the state that is supposed to be correcting those who have social ills, you know, in the correctional system. So my statement is we need to go green. And I appreciate the contribution of the woman officer who said the women are a balance, and I totally agree with that. And I appreciate what the male officer, CO, said when he said they were correctional specialist. And this is a part of going green, because how can you ask someone that is so, I would call, unprepared to deal with what you're not correcting? You don't have a plan to correct. I'll give you an example, not to hold too much time, but to make myself clear. I am one of those people who, when you put someone in the correctional system in my name, the people of the state of Maryland, and you say you're going to correct them, but you don't, you just breached your commitment to the state. That's a breach of promise. I don't want a religious setting of punishment. I want a person to come out there ready to be a taxpayer. I want them to have a change in thought. This is what I mean by go green. And if you're not doing that, then it's bondage, going back to your song, People Get Ready.
Right.
There's a trainer coming. There is nothing going on that I can see in the prison system but bondage that goes back to punishment, which is religious.
Maggie, I think you raised some important points, and I'll just throw this out. When I worked in the system 35 years ago for 2 years, and I was at Hagerstown, I was hired because there was an educational system then that was really pervasive. There were training programs and all kinds of skills. There were college classes. There were high school classes. Mm-hmm. I started a theater program at Hagerstown. There were, all those things existed, and we cut those out of the budget. So we do, in some ways, warehouse people. So I'm curious what your perspective is on, A, what Maggie was saying, what happens when we've kind of taken it from corrections – has become more penal than corrections, I think our system has, A, in general. And B, some people would argue we're housing way too many people in our correctional system. That as a former Warden Gillespie, who used to be a Patuxent, said, he felt that 80% of the people in prison shouldn't be there. They should be in community corrections, close to the community and brought back to the community. It's not to be... that we are putting way too many people inside of our system. So both those questions. What are your thoughts? Jim?
My observation is, and I've worked in community corrections, is that one of the major reasons that people commit crime, not the sole reason, is that they never had the proper survival skills. I would say almost 50% of the people that are being released are homeless. And I mean, what I mean by that is you have to have a home and employment plan before you can be paroled. And what a lot of them do, they're homeless. Some of them don't have a place to go because they've destroyed all their connections with people that they had before they were locked up. And other people come out and come to their mother's house or their baby mother's house, but they're not in charge of that house, and they stay there at the pleasure of that person. And if you can imagine a person being arrested and going to prison, whatever living arrangement they had before they went to prison is gone until they get back out, and they have to reestablish that. We are not addressing that part of the problem. And I think that that's one of the major things we need to do to cut down on the incidence of incarceration.
How do you all feel about that?
Well, working in Annapolis, or being exposed in Annapolis, budget cuts really do add and amplify some of the problems. Short staffing, lack of training, lack of programs inside the institution for the inmates. It does have a chilling effect, not only while they're incarcerated, but when they come back into the communities in which they left from. And if you have some, over the years I've seen the training or educational opportunities cut along with cuts in staffing and training. And so I agree with the caller on a lot of levels that a person who's incarcerated needs to be trained or have the opportunity to get educated and or have some vocational skills in order to be a productive citizen once they're released back into the communities in which they came.
I mean, so do you all think that, there are, that we are incarcerating way too many people? That's part of the problem? That we it's almost impossible for correctional officers to even oversee what they have to do because there's just too many people in prison that many argue should not be in prison. This is a mass incarceration of people for all kinds of crimes, more than any other country in the world, maybe save China.
There are a lot of budget cuts, that's true. But I do know as an active sergeant, there are programs that are still in place, but an individual have to want to change once they come back home into society too. There are still programs, but we do have a lot of budget cuts. That's true.
Yeah, but the programs are much less than they used to be. I mean, in the early 70s, the number of programs for men and women to be able to enter, whether it's getting a high school diploma or a college degree or a master's degree or become an electrician or a butcher or any of those things, don't exist.
Right. But the other thing is
they exist in much smaller, much more limited ways, should say.
But I think somebody decided or discovered that what are we getting in return for those programs? And I think somebody made a decision back there deciding that what we were getting really wasn't worth the money we were spending. So it would be better off if we just not do a lot
you
of
think
those
that
programs.
Was it? Or was it that my read on it, maybe you can disagree, but my read on it was that that when people start cutting money from budgets, who they care about the least are the least among us. And
mental health.
Right.
I mean, they cut the programs in which the people are less likely to be able to speak for themselves.
Right.
So with the cutbacks in mental health, a lot of the closing of our state facilities, going it back into a lot of those people become homeless, they commit crimes, they're infiltrating the penal system. The system is not designed really to deal with mentally ill inmates.
There's a lot of mentally ill inmates.
And there's a lot, right. There's a lot. And in DJS, in juvenile justice. And so there's a lot of domino effect when you cut the budgets in facilities 24/7, such as corrections, and even in mental health facilities, there is a domino effect, and you come up with. I can say at Patuxent, when I started at Patuxent, they had a culinary program, a tailoring program, automotive program. They had a lot of programs that don't exist anymore at that particular facility. And so your recidivism rate, if a person is not prepared to deal with coming back into society, especially if they've had a lengthy incarceration, then their recidivism rate is a lot higher.
And one of the things that the reports also talked about was the two things. But one was the percentage of women who said they've been sexually abused while housed at Jessup. That was one of the highest rates in the country.
At Jessup,
the women's cut.
Okay, MCIW.
MCIW. Excuse me. Yes. That both in terms of inmate to inmate abuse and male and female correction officer sexual abuse to inmates, that's occurred. So what addresses that? What changes that? What stops that?
I used to be a male correctional officer in an institution where we had females, and I was in charge of the rec program. And I took the females to the beach before. I mean, we were allowed to do some of those things legally. But every time I thought of, and some of those females are very attractive, and they would, try to get some advantages if they could. But every time I thought about the female inmates, I also pictured dollar bills with wings on them. So I never allowed myself to be put in a position to, but I have colleagues that have lost their jobs because of that.
As well, they probably should lose their jobs.
Yeah,
I mean, and it's also women to women as well, and men to men. This is not just.
We have a tier over at CDF.
What's CDF?
CDF, Chesapeake Detention Facility,
which is where.
on Madison Street, 401 East Madison Street, right, where I'm currently assigned. We have a tier with women. Anytime women are moved or you have any action with women or any type of interaction with women, we have policies in place that governs it. Anytime a man comes on the tier, there has to be a woman with him. So anytime you have women or man, you should have policies in place. But we are happy that we have our Correctional Officer Bill of Rights that kind of governs us, or, you know, our job, the Bill of Rights that governs our job, that may stop all these assaults. Miss Hill, if you
want to. The Correctional Officer Bill of Rights actually allows due process.
Right.
In that inmates can accuse you of misbehaving or wrongdoing, and in the past you would i.e. be fired and have to fight for your job back, or suspended without pay and have to fight for it back just merely on the say-so. And if they found, when inmates found that they could accuse you of wrongdoing, and that would, maybe you wouldn't let them come out and get ICE or something, or maybe you was the, you know, officer that ran a tight ship. And so they would say that you did something, and all of a sudden, you know, you're suspended or you're up for termination. So with the Correctional Officer Bill of Rights actually has allowed us a due process in that. As far as assaults on inmates, on inmates and staff inmates, I think that when the administration puts in the right policies to help to alleviate that, you can't alleviate all assaults. They happen. I mean, people living in close quarters, they may fight, or things may happen there. And so I really think it's a policy decision that the administration should make.
Right. So let me go back to the phones. We have listeners calling in and get their thoughts at 410-319-8888. Sharon, you're on the air. Sharon, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, I was calling because I've read about the Correctional Officer's Bill of Rights, and I was just wondering, what is this, and is this a problem or not?
The Correctional Officer Bill of Rights is, it allows correctional officers their due process. So in the state personnel and pension systems, it didn't allow for, it wasn't specified that if, let's say, a minor infraction of the rules, maybe I was chewing gum or eating a piece of candy, and then you could be suspended without pay, and you would have to, even without being found guilty of anything, you could be terminated, and then you would have to fight to get your job back and ask for back pay and benefits. This allows correctional officers who have infractions, it allows the administration to investigate, take longer. Before, they only had 30 days. Now they have 90 days to investigate and to recommend discipline. And it also allows for due process, like the Miranda rights. And so, you know, you don't have the right to remain silent, though, because our rules say that you must participate in any kind of conference and hearings. It also doesn't protect dirty officers. And so a lot of people are under the impression that, you know, officers can't get fired. They get fired every day. Yeah. They're up for terminations every day, and they get fired every day. And so those, it doesn't protect a dirty officer. It certainly doesn't protect an officer who has a felony or any kind of charges of that. And they can be emergency suspended without pay, just like the police officer's Bill of Rights. But it really was something that was needed.
Well, let me ask this question, though. I mean, the people have written in the comments like this. It actually was in the Sun papers. So the Bill of Rights allows correctional officers to appeal for any infraction that management imposes. If he appeals, If the appeals board of three correctional officers disagrees with management's discipline of the accused officer, management discipline is dismissed and the case is over. The correctional officer goes back to their job. You cannot rid the department of corruption when the system itself is corrupt. That, I mean, that's another point of view in terms of how the Bill of Rights works, how the bill proceeds. And then when you read investigative pieces like people by Van Smith in the city paper, where he outlines numbers of correctional officers who have either abused inmates, especially in Western Maryland when this has taken place, and some other facilities around here, but mostly in Western Maryland, those officers are still there for the most part. Inmates said they're being abused, they're being beaten, little happens, and that people stay on the job. So is there a contradiction here between the rights of a state employee, the right of a union employee to have job protection? At the same time, does it in some place also allow the corruption to take place?
Well, I would say with if they read the complete Bill of Rights, the Secretary of the Department has the final say. So even though the hearing board, much like the police officer in Baltimore City down at the harbor, the commissioner had the final say and he was terminated, even though his hearing board gave him a 7-day suspension for knocking the kid off his
bike. The skateboard thing.
Mm-hmm. And so that's also with the Correctional Officer Bill of Rights. The secretary of the department has the final say on whether a person is employed or not. As far as those inmates will accuse you if they don't like the way they are being treated. If, like you said, in Hagerstown, if they're strictly by the book, they can accuse an officer of abuse or even of assault. But then, as the Correctional Officer Bill of Rights, it's going to be on the inmate to prove it. No longer can an inmate say, "Miss Hill hit me upside my head," and the next thing you know, before the Bill of Rights, I would be out of a job. Because they would take the word of the inmate first. And then I would have to fight to prove that I didn't hit him upside the head. Well, now it's a due process. So if an inmate says, "I've been abused by Miss Hill," then Miss Hill is removed from that situation. But I don't automatically lose my job. It would have to be the inmate would have to show where and how I abused him. And that's how.
Let me just go to the phones here. We have folks called again. Let's see. Rolf, you have a quick thought?
Yeah, we're not only subject to discipline from the administration, but inmates sue you. I've been sued while I was a correction officer. It didn't work, but I was still sued.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Oh, Rick Benetti, who is from the Department of Corrections online. Rick, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Mark.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Hey, I just wanted to chime in here, and first off, let me make the point that the officers there you have in studio are definitely those that represent 99.5% of the folks that work for public safety and correctional services as correctional officers. I think what I'll reiterate what they said at the beginning of the show in terms of the indictments of these 13 officers there at BCDC. It's about integrity. It's plain and simple about integrity. And, you know, folks that choose to behave in that manner make wrong decisions, and they're paying the consequences for it. So I just wanted to make sure that folks, your audience, know that the officers in your studio today are definitely the folks that represent our rank and file across the board, for sure. And I've got another couple of points, too, some quick points about, and there was some discussion of education and training throughout the system, and just wanted to sort of make sure that your audience knows that sort of the best thing that a correctional system can do is aside from education is to train people in marketable job skills. And last year we employed about 2,000 inmates a month through Maryland Correctional Enterprises who learn and work in market-based in a market-based business that sells products to state governments and nonprofits. So we averaged about 2,000 a month in terms of inmate employment there, almost 3 million hours of labor. And a lot of those folks go out and find success out in the world after they've paid their they've served their sentence. And regardless of whatever budget cuts may or may not have happened over the last two or three decades, we had 26,000, 27,000 inmates in some form of academic or occupational classes behind the fence last year. So I just wanted to make those two quick points. And also to clarify something about the COBRA bill, the Correctional Officers Bill of Rights, in terms of the secretary having final say. That's not completely accurate. The board has final say. The trial board has final say. The department can appeal that decision to the courts. But in terms of going against what the board says, that's not necessarily. It sounded a little cut and dry there. It sounded like it doesn't matter what the board says. The department can still terminate someone. It's not completely accurate. The department has the right to appeal that decision.
So, but you can stay online if you like, but I'm going to get another call in here before the end of the hour at 410-319-8888. Michael in Baltimore, you're on the air. Oh, what happened to Rick? He just left. Okay. Michael, you're on the air.
Okay. Yes, I'm Michael from Baltimore City, and my question is to the panel of guests, knowing what you know about the system, if you or an immediate family member were incarcerated, what would be your biggest fear?
That's a really good question. Thank you. Thank you, Michael. That's a good question.
You want to go first?
It depends on, what the charge is.
What would be the biggest fear for somebody you cared about if they were put in a system, in the system? What would your fear be for them, no matter where they were?
That they didn't receive the treatment or the help that they needed in order to not make bad choices again. Because it really is about people who make choices, and they choose to commit crimes and or if they have an addiction, that they receive the treatment that they need in order to battle their addiction, if that's the reason why.
My biggest fear would be if they were innocent and trying to get free. I think that's where the problem exists.
That's a tough one. Well, as what Ms. Shayla Hill said, the treatment, but also with the different type of inmates and the detainee population, I think for me, to be honest, is the safety of my child and myself, and not so much as the prison system. They don't try to keep the inmates safe. It's just that the type of inmates that they're locking up now, the different mindsets, the different cultures, the different neighborhoods, the different, anybody listening to me know what I'm talking about, just the safety of my child or myself,
I mean, that goes back to one of my original points, which was that if somebody's locked up, I mean, what I would be worried about, because I know people have been inside, I've worked there a little bit, enough to see what I've seen, and that is the abuse that takes place inside those prisons, sexual and physical, inmate to inmate, and sometimes CO to inmate. Those things exist, and we have too many people in our jails. There are too many people there. If you had 80% or 75% fewer people that you had to watch and take care of inside, your jobs would be easier, and the work would be better, and fewer people would get hurt.
But then that go back to the individual. If you go in there and do what you're supposed to do, the integrity, we keep saying integrity, integrity, integrity of the individual while you're working, do what you can do to protect yourself as well as the detainee. And to just piggyback, to go back, the Correctional Officer Bill of Rights real quick, what? The state have the opportunity to root out any bad behavior.
So let me just, we have Jeff Pittman just wrote in saying, the CEO Bill of Rights absolutely does not prevent the state from investigating or rooting out corruption. Over the past year, 22 officers officers have been terminated by the correctional system for fraternization. 20 of 22 terminations stuck. One is on appeal. 20 of 22 is not the batting average of an entity struggling to fire employees, which is what you
have to do. So they have the opportunity to do it. It's up to management to try to root out any corruption. But as far as an officer is concerned, do what you're supposed to do.
Well, we have one last thought. We have 30 seconds. Go ahead, Jim.
The other part about some inmates are responsible for their own abuse because you have, like, mental ill people and people that don't know how to deal with this, personal relationships. They cause other people to assault them.
Well, I want to thank all of you for coming in. I want to also thank you for the work you do the work and have done and for your thoughtful participation in this program, talking about what you think about corrections and about the men and women that you take care of and the men and women you serve with.
Thank you.
Good to have you all here. All right. Jim Dow, former correctional officer and correctional specialist who contacted us at Steiner Show after our programs. Shelley Hill, retired correctional officer who worked at Patuxent for more than 20 years before retiring last year. And Lisa James Henson, who is a correctional officer at the Chesapeake Detention Facility, is a sergeant and president of her union local. Good to have the three of you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great.
We're going to a brief break, and we're going to jump into the issue of trafficking of human beings in our culture and society, why it exists so extensively, what's being done about it, what are the human experiences. Stay with us.